We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many, probably men and women, desperately in need, especially in this room tonight, we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we will be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight I'm going to introduce the introducer. Tinsley Ellis is going to come up and introduce our speaker.
Before I introduce the speaker, I just want to say, Tim, it's great to see you here tonight. You've been our thoughts and our prayers and a great amount of courage it took for you to come here after your recent unpleasantness. Now, when the speaker was announced on a flyer a couple of weeks ago, a lot of people were really excited, and somebody wrote "Wow" on the original flyer that went up because his sobriety date was listed as 1883, which would redefine old timer, as far as I'm concerned. But this is a gentleman who shares his experience, strength, and hope a lot inside and outside the rooms, and he came all the way from Athens, Georgia, to speak tonight. With that, I give you a round.
Thank you, Tinsley. And Tim, thanks. Where are you? Anyway, I'm glad you're out and everything's good. There you are. I love to go to speakers meetings, and I hate to speak, you know. My first impulse when Tinsley asked me is like, I'm busy doing something. And then my AA mind clicks in, and I say, okay, I'll be there. That's kind of the story of my recovery. A lot of times I got to go against my impulses, you know, my adolescent want to run and hide kind of thing, and just stop for a second and say, wait a minute, what does AA tell me to do here? Be of service. It's probably going to do me a lot more good than it does y'all for me to tell the story. So here I am, reluctant, but I'm here. And that's another metaphor for my sobriety. Sometimes I'm reluctant to do the things I'm supposed to do, but I usually do them. And it's worked for me so far since 1883. I didn't realize how much sobriety I had. But one other thing that I have to say for myself is my sponsor down in New Orleans. I got sober in New Orleans. And somebody asked me to speak and tell my story. And I was all freaked out, you know. And he reminded me or told me that it's not a performance, because he knew I was kind of a performer or had been. Wasn't doing any performing when I got sober. But he said, you know, when you tell your story, it's not a performance. And that really scared me, because I knew kind of how to perform, but I didn't know how to get up and tell the truth to people and kind of let people in to my life and to who I was. In fact, I didn't even know who I was the first time I told my story, and I'm just learning, really. But it's important for me to say that so I don't try to make it into something that's not, you know. It's just me telling how it was and what happened and how it is now. And just keep it simple. So that's what I'm going to try to do. Let me just start from the beginning. I came from a little town in South Georgia. My parents were just great, loving people, quiet Southern Baptist types. They didn't drink. They were just good folks, you know. Quiet. We didn't talk about emotions or, you know, but I think that was kind of normal back then too in those days. Didn't do a lot of talking about stuff. And, you know, I have a sister 6 years older, so I was kind of an only child in a way. My sister was gone, you know, when I was in junior high, I guess, off to college. So. And, you know, I was involved with the church and all that, and I learned later as I got sober and started looking at myself that I kind of took on this role in my family of the golden boy kind of role where I was going to be. I think because I thought my parents, and they probably were, depressed. You know, I thought it was just kind of quiet, but I think both of them were kind of depressed. And so it was up to me to kind of keep this boat sailing. I think it's the way I picked it up. Nobody told me this. I just took on this role. And this, it meant that I had to be really good at anything I did. Or I was going to quit and do something else, you know. So, I studied real hard and I made good grades and became, you know, good at music and stuff like that. And got a lot of praise for it. But I never felt very good about myself, even though I was getting these, you know, accolades in a way. And I never felt like I really fit in or I was good enough. I never felt I was good enough. And I think my parents had that too, and I picked it up from them. But it's not a blame thing. I'm just saying that I never felt like I fit in, even though I was achieving. You know, I was a big achiever. And when I first discovered alcohol, a friend of mine's parents, I think I was in junior high or something, but anyway, she let us have some wine at their house, and I had, you know, just enough red wine. I still remember the way that tasted. A couple of glasses, and I felt so grown up all of a sudden, you know, and I felt like I just relaxed, you know, for the first time, I guess. And I remember I didn't go crazy like a lot of my classmates did drinking in high school. I remember some of them would just take, you know, a half pint and just down it. You know, it was like, yeah. And just, you know, they were on a kind of a suicide risk thing, you know. And I didn't do that. I did get drunk a lot on weekends. I played music and got in a band all the way through high school. And, you know, we did party, but I don't think I was doing too much more abusing than anybody else. But I do remember riding around by myself in this little town with a quart of Budweiser between my legs and drinking that quart and riding around and feeling right. I always remember that because I always went back to that when I was drinking, like trying to get to that, yeah, I'm all right. You know, I believe I can handle just about any damn thing. You know, that's the way it made me feel. I loved alcohol. And I did crazy things, but I didn't get in a lot of trouble in high school. In fact, I was achieving and thinking I was going to be a scientist or something. I was so smart. I thought I got accepted at UNC up at Chapel Hill, and I got a scholarship and all that. And I don't know, I didn't know anything about what I wanted to do, but I thought, well, hell, I'll be a biochemist or something like that. That sounds good. So took a few chemistry classes, and that all came crashing down because all of a sudden I was at a big university and I was a little fish, you know, and I was not nearly as smart as I thought I was when I went in there. So I switched over to, English. I ended up, by the time I graduated, I was in religion, you know, because anything that was hard for me and where I couldn't be at the top of the class, I just quit and moved on to something else because I thought I had to be the best at everything. And it just, you know, I actually did love studying about religion and psychology too. I had ended up with two majors. And that today is still some of my biggest, those are my interests in as far as reading and studying. But at the time, I discovered pot and speed and drank more and more during college and started drinking by myself. I remember going to movies by myself, drinking more and more and getting stopped by the cops in college. But still, I don't think I was much worse off than most people I was hanging out with. You know, the the change for me came after I graduated, and I got accepted at a big place to do, to study religion, to be a theologian. Thank you. And I decided at that point, my draft number came, this was 1970, so my draft number, we were all waiting on our numbers, the lottery numbers, you know, like to know if we were going to Vietnam or not. Mine came up high, so I had a choice right then. This is a crossroads in my life. Go up to Harvard Divinity School and become whatever, go to Athens, Georgia and party and play music. And guess which one I did? Yeah. I was so relieved not to have to achieve anything. I just felt great. And I just wanted to party. By that time, I had already been, you know, doing a lot of other stuff besides drinking, too. And I just wanted to drop out and have some damn fun and take the pressure off for a while. You know, I can go back to school anytime. And that lasted until I was 35. You know, basically the party lasted until I came in this program. Of course, the party was not fun the last 5 or 6 years. And a lot of the stuff was not fun at all because I ended up here in Atlanta one time doing a record and I was high on some stuff, and then I decided to take these red downers, second of all, and drink some liquor just to calm down. The next thing I know, I'm in the hospital, you know, overdosed, and luckily the girl I went home with noticed I wasn't breathing. I was 23, I think, maybe 24. You know, but that, it did not even... All it did for me was say, okay, don't do those things together anymore. You'll be all right. Just stop doing, don't do those two things. I learned, that's what I learned from that. You know, so I almost died back in my 20s. I could have used the program then. But, of course, I wasn't ready for that. But anyway, I went to Athens and I knew some folks there in the music thing, and we basically just partied, and I discovered I could kind of write some songs, and you know, I don't want to spend a hell of a lot of time on my drinking, but I started getting DUIs. I started not remembering what happened last night, you know, and that would bother me for a little while, and long enough, you know, it wouldn't last that long. I wouldn't worry about it that much, but it was starting to bother me, and people were starting to tell me, you need to cut back, you know, you're making a fool out of yourself here. You don't even know what you said last night, do you? And I'm like, oh, I know, but I had no idea what I said or where I was or anything. And so I would try to cut back, and this is in my, you know, mid-20s. I started trying to control it a little bit, maybe just switch over to this stuff here and smoke this and just stop drinking that liquor, you know, everything will be all right, just drink beer. My dad said that, just drink beer. And of course that didn't work, you know, it never worked for long. And I got my first DUI right in doing a U-turn in front of Allen's Hamburgers and drunk as hell in the midnight or something. And I said, well, after I sat in jail for a while, somebody bailed me out. I was like, I'm never getting another DUI again, guarantee you. 30 days later, I got another one coming from Savannah, just hauling ass, drunk as hell. It's amazing I didn't die. Got another one down in some little town, South Georgia. That scared me a little bit. It scared me a lot, actually, because I knew I really didn't mean for that to happen. I didn't. I was out of control, and I knew it. So I started keeping a diary at one point so that I could kind of... It was a good idea. You know, I was like, okay, I'm not going to drink. And I feel a lot better. I didn't drink that day. I may have smoked some weed or something, but I wasn't drinking. And I had this diary I kept for a couple of weeks where I wasn't drinking. And then there's an entry that says, well, I had a couple of beers last night and it seems okay. And then there's no more entry, you know. That's the story right there. I'm off and running again, and the hell with a diary. I'm going to have some fun. And so, you know, I was married at that time, and things were not going well. We had this big house where everybody was coming to party, and it was just one big party the whole time. And but yet, people were still telling me, you need to cut back, because you're doing more than we are, you know. You're just embarrassing yourself. And so eventually, I won't go into all the embarrassing things I did. There's a lot of them, like falling off the stage, grabbing the mic and just saying what I really want to say right now in front of a bunch of people, you know, and don't remember what I said. And anyway, a lot of embarrassing things like we all go through. But I moved down at some point. I got divorced, moved down to New Orleans where I had some friends down there where, in my mind, it's like, I want to get the hell away from all y'all folks in Athens, and, you know, because I had created a mess up there for myself with my marriage falling apart and pissing off friends and just not acting right. And so I wanted to go down there where I could get away from all that and drink like I wanted to. It was open 24/7 down there, and I love New Orleans. So met a girl down there, and she let me live with her. She had a little 2-year-old son, and I'm married to her now, by the way. Been married 27 years. So I moved in with her. We had a relationship that was, you know, kind of fell head over heels in love. And I would visit down there, but eventually, when I moved down there and moved in with her, she realized that this was not just a party I was doing when I'd come to New Orleans. I lived like this, you know, and getting up and just throwing up every morning, blurry and bleary, and drinking at whatever time I was going to start that day, and just partying all the way through the night, losing my car. And I was dragging her along too, and because she's not even a drinker, but she was trying to keep up with me. But eventually, she was in therapy at the time, and her therapist told her how to tell me this. She said, I just can't stand to see you. Me and Isaac, the little one, we can't stand to see you killing yourself. So you're going to have to either get sober, do something about your drinking, or leave. And nobody had ever told me that before, you know, because everybody was like, you just cut back some, you know, everything will be all right. She was laying it, and I could tell she meant it. And we had had some fights about this. So when she said that to me, part of me was, the hell would you? You're not going to tell me what to do about my drinking. I guarantee I'll take care of this. And the other parts of me said, yeah, you're right. Because I had actually gotten an abuse. I'm remembering now. I got some an abuse. I tried to stop on my own. I even drank on that after a while. And I had, you know, given it my best shot to cut back and stay stopped, and I couldn't do it. So part of me knew she was right. I remember this time I was driving from New Orleans in the middle of my addiction, carrying guns, paranoid, and I was driving up here to play or something, and I was on the interstate, and I was just at the bottom. This is before she told me this, actually. And I started saying not the Lord's Prayer, the 23rd Psalm. I just started saying it because the only thing I could think of to pray. And I started crying. It was like a huge experience. It was like one of those Bill Wilson kind of, the wind blew through, and I felt mad because I heard this voice said, you have got to stop drinking and drugging. Not cut back, you have got to stop. And it was real calm and beautiful, some voice within me. And I felt like, wow, that's it. And now I'm done. And I felt so relieved and happy. And I was on a pink cloud for about 2 days until I started drinking again, of course. You know, it didn't last. I had a big spiritual experience because I had hit some kind of bottom. I also had this vision at the time. I was probably DTs, but I had a vision of myself. It's a true vision, though, going down in this well and trying to claw my way up. and I was just going down, 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 and it was so clear to me. Then I had this experience, and I'm thinking, well, damn, that's it. I'm good now. It did not last. 30 days later, though, my wife tells me this. I've got to leave. And I finally made a phone call to, I forget the name of the place in New Orleans, but there was a counselor. He said, come over and we'll talk. So I went over, and he said, well, how much do you drink? I said, well, you know, I drank four beers a night, but I got a mental problem. That's not my problem. I got some shit going on up here that's just, you wouldn't believe. And he said, well, let me just tell you something about myself. So he said, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I had never even heard those words together. You know, I didn't know anything about recovery. And he said, I used to drink, and this is what happened to me, and I got sober in AA. And I said, after I heard that, somehow, I said, well, you know what? I really drink more than 4 or 5 beers a night. And I drink my ass off every day. And I even sat in this little old shotgun house the other day and drank a case and did not even get drunk. In fact, I drank myself sober. I just started telling him the truth, you know, which I had not done since I was a little kid, I don't think. Told the real truth. And I said, I'm about to kill myself. And he said, well, go to this, I'm going to send you over here to this AA meeting at Tulane University tomorrow, and I'm going to have somebody meet you there. So I went. And my first meeting, I don't know about, it's different for everybody. My first meeting, I felt relieved. Like, damn, this, first of all, these people seem happy and healthy, and here I am dragging ass in here just shaking. And they told me that I had a disease of alcoholism. And everything they said made sense to me. Like, the first drink is what gets you. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was the fourth or fifth one that got me. No, just stay away from that first one, and you don't have to drink again, they told me. You don't have to drink again. I just knew I had to drink. I just had to. I could not face the way I felt. And they said, no, you don't. Just today, just don't drink today. Come back tomorrow. We'll tell you how this works. And I felt relieved. Like, damn, there's some hope for me. And this is what is wrong with me. I did not know what was wrong with me. I just thought I was a weak person who was so screwed up he couldn't even cut back on his drinking, you know. Just kept going down. So, let me tell you a couple of things that happened to me. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, like they told me. I pretty much said, okay, whatever y'all say, I'm doing it. Because I was ready. I'm glad, I'm really glad I had tried on my own before and failed, because I was ready for some help. And I think that probably saved my ass. But 30 days, I think it was, into my sobriety, whatever it was not drinking. I was feeling good, but then I had a gig to play in some marina down in Florida with a group, and it was a theater, actually. So I got a, you know, I said, sure, I got it. So I went down there and played, and it was not a very good gig. The audience was kind of quiet, and didn't seem like we were going over very well. I was getting nervous as hell, and I look around, and everybody else is drinking, you know, on stage, and knocking back some beers and feeling okay. So we took a break, and I'm getting freaked out. Like, I got to have something to drink here. I've got to have some relief. I can't go back on that stage and feel this bad. And I walked out, and there's a pool out there by the marina, and it's just me and the security guard sitting there. Don't ask me. It's an old guy. Like, if I remember, he had white hair. I don't know. But he didn't say anything to me. He just said to me, I know how to pray. He said, I just get up and thank God every morning that I'm alive and the sun is rising. He just went on. And I didn't even say anything to him. He didn't say, hello, how you doing? He just said, I know how to pray. And it shook me up so much. It was like it took my mind off myself long enough for me to by the time he got through talking, I hear the band is playing. I forgot to go back in. They already started it. It's a concert. So he took me, this is one of those God things, I'm sure, but he took me to a place where it was like, okay, everything's all right. Go back in there and do it. And I felt so relieved and calm that I thought, well, man, this is great. Miracles happen in this program. And that kind of got me on the road to believing, well, maybe there is such a thing as a higher power. I'll give it a shot. Another thing that happened was about 3 months into the program, I hadn't really worked steps. I kind of did 1, 2, 3 with my temporary sponsor. Didn't have a sponsor. And I was on the Amtrak coming up here to play or something. I can't remember what it was for, but I was by myself on the Amtrak. And I'm coming through Birmingham, and it dawned on me that the club car was there, which is what I always used to go to when I was on Amtrak, and stay in that club car and drink. It just hit me. Oh, my God, the club car. I've got to go there. It was like my alcoholic mind was real strong. And then I thought, well, hell, I can't go there. I can't go drink. I'm sober now. And I was freaking out. I got my big book. I had my big book with me, thank God. And I opened it up, and I'm just thumbing through trying to get calmed down a little bit because I wanted to go drink so bad. And the guy across the aisle from me says, hey, man, I noticed you're in the program. He said, you know, my ex-wife lives in Birmingham, and I'm going up to speak in Atlanta. I got to talk to somebody. And I said, okay, let's go talk. So we went to the club car and talked and saved my ass again. So, and maybe his too, I don't know. He was feeling bad about his ex-wife or something. So that was another one of those God things, and that kept me going, you know, because I definitely didn't have my feet in this program. I was just going to meetings, and this is, you know, what I had to do. I finally got a sponsor. I was watering. I took a job with these two guys that had a... my career in music, by the way, had just bottomed out. I didn't have anything going. Really nothing was happening for me because I had pretty much, the whole business was out and I had trashed my career. So I decided I would work for these two guys who had an interior plant place. You know, they like these plants, they water. You water, they put them in, you water them. You know, you go, I watered plants with a little cart around these big oil buildings in New Orleans, 20-something floors, around and around and around. And it was great for me. I'd never had a job before. And so I get up at 7 o'clock and go get my fan with the cart and everything, get in the elevator and start watering plants all day long. And I felt good. It was like, damn, I'm sober. I got a job. And this feels right. Because I knew I was on the right track. I was going to meetings. I wasn't drinking. I was making a little money, you know. And I didn't really care. I decided if music was, it was so tied up with drugs and alcohol for me, playing and being around the club scene and the whole thing was so tied up that I just let it go, and sobriety was more important than me being a musician and me being a performer or whatever. I let it go. And believe me, I loved music. But I also loved the sobriety thing a lot because I knew there was something there. It wasn't just about not drinking. It was about a spiritual life, which is really what I was looking for since I was carrying that quart of beer around in high school, trying to get feeling right. It was the answer for me. It was like, this is how you live. They got the answer here. They can teach me how to live, and it was working, and have a connection with a higher power. And I can choose that higher power. I like that because I didn't like church. I gave that up. I'm so defiant about stuff like that, that I needed something like this where you could, it was higher power. You could find your own higher power, a loving higher power. So I knew I was on the right track. I did that for 3 years. I got a sponsor. finally I got this sponsor who scared the hell out of me in meetings. He was so outspoken. And he was, his dad had committed suicide, and he would talk about how mad he was. He expressed his feelings, which shocked the hell out of me, you know, quiet Southern Baptist guy that I am. And so I, at some point, I tried to work steps on my own, like four. I'm going to work four, and I tried it, and I couldn't figure out how to work the step. And I kept hearing about people ended up in a bar. I don't know how I got there. I just started drinking, man. I said, that's going to happen to me if I don't get me a sponsor. I got scared because I really wasn't in the program yet. I was coming to meetings, but I wasn't in the lifeboat yet. I didn't have my feet on the ground yet. I was feeling relieved and great and on a pink cloud, but I still was, just, I was floating. So I asked this guy to be my sponsor. He said, sure. So we went to his house. He told me about himself. He said, well, we work one, two, and three. We're going to work four now. And he told me, he said, let me tell you about my style. He was a wild-ass French Quarter character. And he told me some stuff that he did. And I was like, damn, I guess I can tell my story now. Because, man, he was wild. I had never heard some of the stuff he was talking about. So I wrote my little story down. And it actually was not... It was hard because I had, even though I hadn't acted out like he did, I had a lot of shame about myself and about things I had done, the way I treated people, women, the way I treated women over the years, the way I treated, I was so competitive, I had hurt all my friends. I mean, all the shame I was carrying, I didn't even know it until I started writing it down. And then I got to my father, who I thought, well, I just love my father. And then I started writing about it. I was mad as hell at my father. I thought he abandoned me when I was a teenager. I thought he just quit and didn't love me anymore. And I was so mad. And when I read my fifth step to him, it took a couple of days to get through this thing. I was sitting at his house, and I said, I'm so damn mad with my father. And I was feeling it. And well, he said, well, first we're going to put the knives away in the kitchen here. We're not going to. Because I said, I want to just tear your damn house up. That's what I told him. These are honest words, though. I was angry. And I said, well, what do I do? You know, I'm so damn mad. He said, we're going to go walk down the street, me and you. We went and walked in his neighborhood. And it was like the most powerful thing, I think, that has ever happened to me was that little bit of walking. Because what he told me was I can walk through this feeling and I don't have to act out on it. It doesn't have to hurt me. I just have to feel it and feel it with somebody as a witness, kind of as a support person, somebody who's been there before. And that was the biggest lesson, I guess, that I've had, one of the big ones. Walk through it, feel it. Because he told me, you know, you're coming to life. You've been dead for a long time, and you got to feel. It's like waking up from a car crash. You know, you got bruises, but you're going to heal if you just go through it and feel it. That had never occurred to me. My whole point of life was to run from feelings, you know. That's why I loved alcohol. I could run from everything. I could avoid everything. He taught me how to walk straight through it, but not by myself. He never said, you got to do this all by yourself. So we went through that fifth step, and all of a sudden I felt like a human being, just one of the crowd, you know, and I was in the program for the first time. I didn't have to worry about ending up in a bar drunk. If I was going to do that, it'd be my own damn choice. It wasn't going to be like some, you know, subconscious thing where I wake up drunk. It would be a conscious decision, I think. So I was in the program then. Then I had to make my amends and all this. Not easy. Very difficult stuff. But all of it has been the best stuff that I've ever done, too. And that, you know, the AA program asked me to do all this terrifically hard, difficult stuff. And it all is the easier, softer way of living, really, because without doing this, I'm going to be suffering my ass off all the time because I'm holding it all in. I'm not making amends. I'm not being honest. AA has taught me to be real, to get real, to be honest, to be authentic. And I really didn't know who I was and didn't, you know, have a clue of what to do in my life. Even after I worked the steps, I was still watering plants, you know, for 3 years down there. And that stuff got boring after a while, let me tell you. And it occurred to me that, you know, just because you're sober, you know, you've left a big part of yourself behind in sobriety because you're scared of it. And that was the part of me that was creative, a little bit risk-taking, vulnerable. And so I said, okay, I think I'm gonna try to write a song sober, which I had never done before, believe me. I used coke to get up there and booze to do this, and, you know. So I just sat at a little piano I had in New Orleans and played around some, and eventually I had a song. It wasn't that good, but it was okay, you know, and it felt good. And it was like coming home a little bit, you know, like, wow, yeah, I'm supposed to have a life beyond water and plants and going to meetings, you know. So I kept doing that, and I learned how to write sober, and I've written a lot of stuff since then. But one of the big things that taught me was just show up and play around a little bit. Just show up. Don't wait around all the time for the way I used to do it. Was just, okay, we got a record coming up. We got to get messed up so we can write some songs, you know, like a week before the thing is due. And now I try to show up on a regular basis, just play around with some things. And everybody's got creativity in millions of different ways. And I think AA has taught me just go there and play around a little bit and just keep going back. Keep going back there and playing. And eventually you have something beautiful. It just comes up. So that's been my experience for the scary part of, you know, whatever creativity is scary sometimes because it feels out of control, and it is. But it doesn't have to be that kind of drinking out of control thing. I don't have to go into that bad place. I can be scared and be vulnerable and still be sober. So I decided to go back to school. I thought, well, hell, I'm not going to have a music career anymore. Whoops. So the only thing I knew about was addiction, so I said, I'll go back to school and go to social work school and become a counselor or something. I don't know. So I went up to Georgia and went to school and brought my family up to Athens. People that leave New Orleans, they're not happy because the food's not right, the coffee's not right, people aren't right. There's no Mardi Gras, you know. But so she stuck it out with me, and I owe her big time for that because I kind of conned them in. I said, look, I'm just going to go up there to school, then we'll go back to New Orleans. But I wanted to stay and get back in the music business. But anyway, I went to social work school, and about halfway through social work school, I get this call from a big rock star English guy. His people, actually not him, but his people call me and said, you want to be in this band? I said, damn right, I sure do. I love this guy. So they said, well, rehearsal start in Nashville in a couple of weeks. And okay, I'll be there. And so I made the decision to stop, take a break from the school. I could come back and finish up, which I did. So I went up, and I hadn't even picked up a horn in God knows how many, a long time. I didn't even own a tenor saxophone, which they were wanting. And I went up there and jumped in the middle of this with all these super musicians, and I didn't feel worth a damn. I felt so out of place, and I was so behind these guys and so less than. It was all that old feeling again of insecurity. I even got paranoid, like they're going to send me on a bus tomorrow back to Athens because they realize what a terrible musician I am. And these were real feelings. And luckily, I went to meetings in Nashville. You know, I told them how I was feeling. I'm feeling terrible. I'm scared shitless. I want to do this, but I'm not prepared. You know, so I had to just work, 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 and try to get up to speed. And it turned out they kept that. They did a long tour, worldwide tour, and went to meetings in Japan and Australia and all over the place. And I stayed sober during this, but it was the most, just about the most painful thing I've ever done in sobriety, because I felt so inadequate. But the program worked for me. I stayed sober, and they kept asking me back on these tours for 16 years. Nobody else got asked back. All these super guys. The sober one got asked back. And I was like, that is amazing. But anyway, it just showed me that I can walk through things sober that I just didn't think I could do. And school was another one. That was not easy for me either. I wasn't been out of school for so long, I couldn't even think, you know. But anyway, I made it through that. I did some counseling, and then I got another call, and I eventually let the counseling go, and I became a musician again, a songwriter. And, you know, that has been a beautiful part of my sobriety, to be able to go back to what I really loved doing and do it sober this time. Because, you know, I've gotten so many, blessings just being able to be there and remember and be aware and be present when all this is happening, and play some beautiful places. I've had to kind of, I decided to do a solo thing and try to do my own career, and that's been very difficult and still is. And but you know, it's just another blessing to be able to find out what I want to do and ask myself what I want to do. What is it that I want to do? What means the most to me, and trying to do it. So it wasn't being on a sideman on some big tour. It really wasn't that. It was writing a good song and recording a good song of my own. That's what I wanted to do. So the money's not very good, but I'm doing what I want to do these days. You know, I'm just still making meetings and still struggling through the hardest things in my sobriety have been relationships with the people closest to me. I still have some trouble with that. And what happens to me is I go back into my adolescent, defiant, pissed off, defensive mode with people. And I still struggle with that. And instead of being able to listen to somebody when they're saying, you know, you're self-absorbed, you're not paying any attention, you're not present, instead of doing that, I can get real defensive and withdrawn and punishing. Now, this is the honest truth. Punish people by being silent. You know, like my wife, for instance. So I came over here to Atlanta. I got a lot of outside help over the period of, you know, when I moved up to Athens. I came over here to a group, therapy group for, I don't know, several years. I'm driving once a week over here because I wanted to deal with some marriage stuff and personal stuff that I just didn't think AA was, it's not supposed to deal with everything, you know. It was keeping me sober so I could get some help with some stuff. But now I kind of needed some specialized care, you know. So I learned that what I was doing was I was dropping back into my old adolescent mode, and what I needed was a good, strong adult AA mind, and that is what I try to do today. Stand up and get back my AA adult mind. And that is so hard sometimes when I'm in the middle of being mad with somebody, or when I feel like I've been abused or criticized. The golden boy is not supposed to be criticized. When I get that defensive thing going, it's a real challenge for me. And this is the challenge in my life, I think. Get out of that mode and get in the AA clear thinking adult mode, which is just listen to what they're saying. You don't have to buy it all, but don't get defensive. I'm here. My adult mind is here. And that to me is what AA is trying to teach me. Just step back. Don't react, and don't go cussing people out, and don't withdraw. That's the old behavior. And to me, it's my old adolescent behavior, because I recognize that when somebody hurt my feelings, I go in my room, don't talk to anybody, I just hold it onto that anger and that shame. So this is the challenge. There's always challenges for me in sobriety, but this is a big one. come up out of that, stand up. And I tell myself, stand up. You can listen to what people say, even if it's critical. And you can do the right thing. You don't have to act out in some crazy way and let them know what you're thinking about them, you know, and what they, how much they've hurt you. You just need to listen, take it in, decide whether it's true or not, talk to another person, stand up, you know, that's, instead of just falling back into that old, the hell with you, the hell with everybody, fuck y'all, you know. That's the way I get. So it's a message that I learned. Stand up and be an adult here. Wait a minute, just listen. It's not, they're not trying to hurt you here. So these are the things. There's a million little things like this that I'm trying to learn in sobriety. And that's why it's such an adventure. Every year is an adventure. Every day is an adventure. There's always challenges. So I'm just real grateful to be sober and have a chance to learn this stuff. Because believe me, when I came in here, I was in bad, bad shape, and I hadn't learned anything in many years except, you know, just what can I get to kill this pain. So now, I do have pain, but I'm learning from it. That's the big difference. I do cry, but the tears do heal now instead of just the way I was crying drunk. Didn't do a damn thing. Didn't change anything, so I just encourage all y'all newcomers, hang in there, walk through it with somebody else. You're not supposed to do it yourself, by yourself. Just keep coming back, and thank you. Thanks, Kinsley.
Thank you, Tim.
What a great story, Randall. Thanks so much for coming over from Athens. You really told my story, except for the part where the English rock star calls. Okay, seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Donations support the group and AA at the zone level. And I've asked Philip to give out the chips.
Anybody else for the white chip? All right, after 30 days, it's a silver chip with something on it. Anybody got 30 days? Nobody got 30 days?
Green 90?
Red?
I got one.
Huh?
I got
two. 90 days? Anybody else got 9 days? About 6 months. Yellow. No yellow. 9 months. Green. Anybody got 9 months? Anybody got a year or multiple of the years?
Still longer than alcohol. 18 years. That's over here. We've got Mars Potts. Told me there are 6 things I need to do to keep it simple. The one being a competent sponsor. Work all 12 steps. Learn to pray. Work with others. And do those things. I've got a great chance of getting sober and staying sober. If I'm not willing to do all 6 of those things, I have no chance of getting. Thank you very much for your story. It was wonderful. You really helped me. I'm going to talk to you after the meeting about that, holding that stuff. Yeah. Thanks very much.
All right, anybody else got a year or multiple? Anybody else have second thoughts on those white chips? Or reconsider? All right, thanks.
All right. Let's see now. Do we have any AA-related announcements? No announcements? Alrighty. If you would like to become a member of this home group, see one of the home group members who are raising their hands now. I would like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. And for those of you who will, we have a nice way of closing.
Thank you. Down to earth I've been, rested in.